If you look at the tech world today, you know, the biggest companies aren't just they aren't just selling you software anymore. They're essentially acting like digital landlords.
Right, yeah, like they're raising the rent on your old operating system or renting out AI supercomputers by the hour and even launching thousands of satellites to, I mean, literally own the sky above you.
Exactly. Welcome to the deep dive. Whether you are catching up on the tech world or just insanely curious, we are customizing this deep dive just for you.
We really are. Because we are seeing a complete reconstruction of the invisible scaffolding that holds up modern life.
Yeah, the sheer scale of the physical and digital construction happening right now is something we haven't witnessed since, well, probably since the initial laying of the commercial internet back in the late 90s.
Oh, for sure. It's a massive shift.
Today, we are looking at a stack of notes from the Tikkun Morning Tech Briefing, specifically the one from Wednesday, August 12, 2026.
It was a very packed briefing.
It really was. Our mission today is to extract the vital signals from six massive breaking tech stories. Today's theme is infrastructure and scale.
Right, so how the biggest players in tech are securing our past, redefining the tools we build with, and constructing the literal physical foundations of our future, both down here on Earth and, you know, up in orbit.
Okay, let's unpack this. And I think we should start with the most immediate issue affecting the devices you probably have sitting on your desk right now.
Oh, yeah, the Microsoft patch.
Right. Microsoft just dropped its largest patch Tuesday in history. They plugged over 400 security vulnerabilities in a single update.
Which is just staggering. To give that some historical context, the previous record was, I think, 289 vulnerabilities back in May 2025.
Right, so a huge jump.
Exactly. Jumping to over 400 isn't just a slightly busier month for IT administrators. It signals a fundamental shift in Redmond's security strategy, especially when you look at the severity of what they're actually patching.
Yeah, because there are some genuinely scary things in this patch. I mean, it includes 3 zero-day vulnerabilities.
Yeah, those are the ones keeping security teams up at night.
For sure. The one grabbing all the headlines is tracked as CVE-2026-68820.
Right, the Winsock one.
Exactly. It's an actively exploited zero-day in the Windows Winsock driver, which is essentially, well, it's the gatekeeper for how Windows handles internet traffic.
And it has a CVSS severity score of 7.0 out of 10, making it a very high priority threat.
Right, and reports from Bleeping Computer and Krebs on security confirm it's already being used in the wild by the Lazarus Group.
Yeah, that highly sophisticated threat actor linked to North Korea.
Exactly. And they are using it for targeted attacks, likely using that Winsock vulnerability as, you know, a silent entry point for lateral movement inside corporate networks.
Now, Microsoft's rapid response team mobilized incredibly fast for that specific threat. I mean, they got all Azure servers patched within 48 hours.
Which is impressive, yeah.
It is. But looking at the wider patch, 42 of these 400 bugs are classified as critical, and they mostly involve remote code execution.
Which means what exactly for the average user?
It means an attacker can run malicious code on your machine from a completely different continent, without you ever clicking a single link.
Wow, that is terrifying.
It is. Plus, two of the bugs in Office 2016 and SharePoint were already publicly disclosed online before this patch even came out. So there was this window where systems were entirely
I
defenseless.
mean, this massive dump just feels like Redmond is ripping the Band-Aid off. It's like they are tired of playing whack-a-mole with legacy code and, you know, they've decided to stop accumulating all this security debt.
What's fascinating here is the strategic pivot behind that exact feeling.
Right, because this wasn't an accident.
No, not at all. Following the major security incidents of 2024 and, well, the resulting intense pressure from the U.S. Congress, internal security teams at Microsoft were ordered to abandon their old gradual release strategy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, previously, if they found lower risk vulnerabilities, they might delay patching them just to, you know, spread out the testing and deployment workload.
Make it easier on the IT guys.
Exactly. But now they are operating on a mass release mandate. They're clearing the backlog, just pushing everything out the door to force a clean slate for the ecosystem.
Right. But while Microsoft is forcing a clean slate for security, they are simultaneously using aggressive pricing to force businesses into their modern Windows ecosystem.
Yes, the Windows 10 phase out.
Right, because October 14, 2025 marked the end of the road for Windows 10, meaning it shifted to the Extended Security Updates Program, or ESU.
Right.
So this massive 400 bug update will not deploy automatically to a Windows 10 machine. And the pricing structure they just announced to stay secure is, well, it's built to inflict maximum financial pain.
Oh, the compounding cost model they've introduced for organizations is staggering. Year one of ESU, which ends in October 2026, costs an organization $61 per device.
Which, I mean, feels annoying, but maybe manageable for a small business, right?
You'd think so, but then they turn the screws. It doubles every single year.
Wait, doubles?
Yeah. So year two is $122 per device.
Yeah.
And year three is $244.
That is insane. So by January 2030, an organization is paying a total of $427 for every single Windows 10 machine they refuse to upgrade.
Exactly, which is often more than the residual hardware value of the laptop itself.
Right. It's like a landlord drastically raising the rent just to force a tenant out of an old building.
And that is a deliberate tactic. Mm-hmm. I mean, Microsoft ran this exact same playbook with Windows 7, and it successfully drove 85% of enterprise users to Windows 10.
Right. So they know it works.
Yeah. They are replicating that strategy to push businesses to Windows 11.
But the problem with that strategy this time around is the hardware floor. I mean, we know Windows 11 has strict requirements.
Mm.
Specifically, it requires a TPM 2.0 hardware security chip for secure boot and encryption.
Yes, that is a huge bottleneck.
Right, so if a school district or a small clinic has a fleet of older machines without that chip, or, you know, they're running a 7th gen Intel CPU, they are physically incapable of upgrading.
They are completely stuck.
Exactly. Isn't this just punishing users who physically can't upgrade? They are trapped into paying this extortionate ESU fee.
Well, Microsoft did anticipate the backlash, which is why they carved out a somewhat softer landing for home users.
Okay, so home users get a break.
Yeah, home users can actually get 1 year of free ESU by enabling Windows backup or redeeming 1,000 Microsoft rewards points or just paying a flat $30.
Oh, okay. That's not too bad.
And following massive community pushback earlier in the summer, they even automatically granted enrolled home users an additional free year.
Right. But what about the organizations?
For organizations, there is zero flexibility. They even implemented a strict cumulative licensing rule to enforce compliance.
Oh, man. And that cumulative rule is brutal. It means an IT department can't just ignore updates for 2 years, take the risk, and then jump in at year three to save cash.
No, Microsoft will absolutely force you to back pay for the years you skipped.
Wow. So if you enroll in year two, you pay for year one.
Exactly. It completely prevents organizations from gaming the system.
And just to rub salt in the wound, this ESU only covers critical and important security patches. You don't get any new features. Your operating system is essentially in, like, hospice care.
That's a good way to put it. The overarching theme here is control. Microsoft is using pricing to tightly control the enterprise environment and, you know, lock the front door of their ecosystem.
Which makes the timing of this next story brilliant. Because while Microsoft is busy locking the front door, their closest partner is sneaking in the back to steal their developers.
Right. OpenAI.
Yeah. Let's look at OpenAI. They just released the preview version of their ChatGPT desktop application for Linux.
And they're specifically targeting heavy-duty developer distributions here. So Ubuntu 24.04 and 26.04 LTS, Debian 13, and Fedora 43 and 44.
Right, which effectively completes their desktop trilogy, giving them coverage across all major operating systems. But the timing is just wild.
The frenemy dynamic between Microsoft and OpenAI is reaching a completely new level of brazenness.
It really is. I mean, OpenAI dropped this Linux app simultaneously with Microsoft Build 2026.
Yeah, they launched it literally right as Microsoft executives were on stage unveiling their own developer product, GitHub Copilot Workspace.
Talk about a hostile news cycle.
Right.
But structurally, this new OpenAI app is built on Electron, which is that web-based framework notorious for hogging system memory.
Yeah, developers always complain about Electron apps.
Exactly. And developers on Reddit are already complaining because the install size is a hefty 280 megabytes.
Mm.
I mean, for a chat interface, that sounds absurdly bloated.
Well, a 280 megabyte footprint would be completely unjustified for a simple chat wrapper, yeah. But that footprint is hiding a secret weapon.
Oh, what is it?
A massive chunk of that storage is dedicated to the Codex module and offline code prediction models.
Okay.
Yeah. OpenAI is actively trying to dominate the developer tools market. This app isn't just a browser window. It has deep terminal integration, local project management capabilities, and it connects natively to the OS clipboard.
That's a lot of power.
It is. But the real disruptor is the offline auto-completion. Even when a developer is sitting on an airplane with no internet connection, Codex can offer local, instantaneous code suggestions for popular languages like Python, JavaScript, TypeScript, and Go.
That offline capability is huge. especially for enterprise developers handling highly sensitive corporate IP who just, you know, they don't want their code snippets sent to a cloud server.
Exactly. It's a massive selling point for privacy.
But it still begs the question. I mean, GitHub Copilot essentially owns the market right now. Microsoft owns GitHub. Developers have already built their workflows around it. Why would a developer abandon that for ChatGPT?
It becomes a calculation of flexibility versus the walled garden.
Okay, how so?
Well, GitHub Copilot costs $10 a month, but it is heavily restricted.
Right.
It only operates within Visual Studio Code and a handful of specific integrated development environments, or IDEs.
Right, you're locked in.
Exactly. ChatGPT Plus costs double. It's $20 a month. But it breaks out of the IDE completely. You can use it in any development environment, terminal, or text editor across your entire Linux system.
Oh, I see.
Furthermore, that $20 grants access to GPT-4, DALL-E 3 for image generation, and the Codex engine.
So it's an entire suite of AI tools speaking natively to your operating system, whereas Copilot is just a highly specialized coding tool trapped inside a specific window.
Precisely.
Okay, so you have developers writing cutting-edge AI code natively on Linux, but all of that AI prediction, generation, and training requires a massive physical engine running somewhere.
Oh, absolutely.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because the undisputed hardware king, NVIDIA, is making a move that fundamentally changes the global tech economy.
Yeah, NVIDIA is evolving far beyond a company that simply sells silicon chips. They are positioning themselves as the primary architect and landlord of global AI infrastructure.
Right. They just announced a partnership with a consortium of the biggest titans on Wall Street. We're talking Apollo, BlackRock, Blackstone, Brookfield, Goldman Sachs, and KKR.
Some serious heavy hitters.
Yeah. And together, they are mobilizing $500 billion to build an independent financing platform specifically for AI compute infrastructure.
Right.
Like we said earlier, they aren't just selling the bricks anymore. They are financing and building the entire AI city, essentially offering turnkey infrastructure.
And the rhetoric coming from the financial sector on this is unprecedented. Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, spoke at the announcement and stated unequivocally, he said, "We believe AI compute is a new asset class."
A new asset class.
Yeah. And he projects it will yield 8 to 12% annual returns for institutional investors.
Calling a data center a new asset class really elevates it to the level of commercial real estate.
Exactly.
They are treating racks of GPUs the way a municipal government treats toll roads, bridges, or airports.
Yeah.
You know, as foundational income-generating infrastructure.
And this means institutional investors can now bypass tech stocks entirely and pour capital directly into the physical infrastructure of AI.
Right.
NVIDIA is executing this under that turnkey infrastructure model you mentioned. They are actively constructing dedicated, massive-scale data centers in the U.S., Europe, and the Middle East.
And the Vanguard project is a facility in Texas, slated to launch in late 2026.
Yes, and the specs on that Texas data center highlight the sheer scale of what $500 billion buys. It will draw 500 megawatts of power.
Just to put that in perspective for you listening, 500 megawatts is enough electricity to power a medium-sized city of several hundred thousand homes.
It is a phenomenal amount of energy, and it will house over 100,000 H200 GPUs under one roof.
So how does a startup even afford to get in the door there?
Well, the business model for accessing that compute power flips the traditional startup trajectory on its head.
Right.
Previously, an AI startup requiring 1,000 H100 GPUs to train a foundational model had to secure roughly $30 million in venture capital just to purchase the hardware upfront.
Which is a huge barrier to entry.
Exactly. Under this new platform, the capital expenditure becomes an operational expense. Startups will rent the compute capacity monthly.
Okay, so NVIDIA is essentially spinning up its own version of AWS or Azure, but hyper-optimized exclusively for AI workloads.
Yes.
Which is a direct, aggressive shot across the bow of Azure Machine Learning and Google Cloud TPU.
Oh, definitely. But NVIDIA is playing the role of an exclusive bouncer at the door of this new data center.
What do you?
They have strict rules for what they call qualified customers. You have to prove a minimum market value of $10 million, and you must operate an AI-first business model.
Okay. That feels like a very targeted rule designed specifically to block crypto miners from hoarding the compute capacity with, you know, non-productive, energy-intensive workloads.
That is precisely the intent. NVIDIA watched the crypto booms of the last decade disrupt their supply chains and totally alienate their core gaming and professional demographics.
They definitely don't want a repeat of that.
Right. They want this new infrastructure entirely dedicated to driving enterprise AI innovation.
But still, pouring $500 billion into the physical infrastructure of AI is a massive gamble.
Oh, huge.
There has to be sustainable, mass consumer demand at the other end of the pipe to justify that kind of electrical and financial output.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to interrogate the user adoption metrics. Has that theoretical consumer demand actually materialized into daily habits?
According to Google's latest earnings call, the answer is a resounding yes. Sundar Pichai just announced that the Gemini app hit 1 billion monthly active users in under 18 months.
That is incredibly fast.
It is. That milestone makes Gemini the fastest growing product in the history of Google. Just for comparison, it took Chrome 8 years to hit 1 billion users.
Wow.
And it took Google Maps 10 years to reach that scale.
And the usage habits underneath that headline number reveal a real shift in how humans interact with computers. Yeah, users are generating 150 million images every single day. And more importantly, 63% of users are utilizing the voice feature.
Also, they're talking to Gemini rather than typing queries.
Exactly. That transitions AI from a search engine alternative into a form of ambient computing.
Right. It's just always there.
And Google is pressing the advantage by rolling out Imagen 3 by September, which brings 2048 by 2048 photorealistic image generation down to all their free users.
I mean, I have to play the skeptic here, though.
Go for it.
1 billion users is a phenomenal press release, but is this actual organic love for the product?
You're wondering how they got there so fast.
Yeah, because this smells exactly like the Microsoft Edge playbook. Google baked Gemini directly into Android 15 as the unchangeable default assistant.
They did.
They bundled it automatically into every single Google Workspace and Gmail account. And they pushed it to 505 million Jio telecom subscribers in India through a massive, inescapable marketing partnership.
It was a very aggressive rollout.
Right. So how many of those billion users just accidentally triggered Gemini because it hijacked the power button on their new phone?
That is a completely valid skepticism. I mean, the artificial inflation of early user numbers through default placements is a very well-documented tactic in tech.
Right.
However, the internal telemetry suggests the engagement is actually solidifying.
Really?
Yeah. Google's data shows that weekly retention is growing at a remarkable pace. In the first quarter of 2026, only 42% of the people who had Gemini installed actually engaged with it on a weekly basis.
Okay.
But by Q2, just a few months later, that weekly retention metric jumped to 67%.
Wow. Okay. That completely undercuts the accidental click theory.
Yeah.
I mean, people might be forced into the ecosystem by default, but a jump from 42% to 67% retention means they are finding enough utility to make it a deliberate habit.
Exactly. The initial acquisition might be artificial, but the sustained habit building appears to be entirely genuine. So the demand for the compute power that NVIDIA is building is real.
Wow. So we've dissected the physical foundation of the internet down here on Earth, right? The aggressive operating system strategies, the developer tools, the power-hungry data centers.
It's a lot of terrestrial infrastructure.
It is. But let's look up, because while everyone is fighting over silicon and desktop software on Earth, SpaceX is quietly and methodically claiming ownership of the sky.
Yeah, orbital infrastructure represents the ultimate high ground for global connectivity.
On Tuesday, August 11th, SpaceX executed the Starlink 1019 mission. A Falcon 9 rocket successfully deployed 29 Starlink V2 mini satellites into low Earth orbit.
And we should note, these V2 minis are technological behemoths compared to the early iteration.
Yeah, they weigh 800 kilograms each. And they feature advanced argon hull thrusters, which gives them 4 times the data capacity of the older generation.
The hardware is impressive for sure, but the truly astonishing metric is the operational cadence. I mean, this launch marked the 93rd Falcon 9 flight of 2026.
And it's only August.
Right. They are maintaining a launch tempo of 1 rocket every 3 days.
That is wild.
It is. They have already eclipsed their total 2025 record, which stood at 81 launches for the entire year.
They just keep accelerating.
Furthermore, the first stage booster used for this mission, which is designated B2085, was making its 5th flight.
Okay, so it's a veteran booster.
Very much so. This specific piece of hardware previously flew the Crew 9 and Fram-2 missions.
Oh, wow. So it literally carried human astronauts to the International Space Station and over the Earth's poles.
Exactly. And now it has been refurbished and repurposed to haul commercial internet routers into the vacuum of space.
The flight path for this specific launch was also highly specialized, wasn't it?
It was. Instead of the standard easterly or southeasterly trajectory out of Florida, they flew a northeasterly trajectory.
Why is that?
To insert these satellites into a much higher polar orbit, they are intentionally building out dense coverage for Scandinavia and northern Canada, essentially blanketing the isolated parts of the globe where laying traditional subterranean fiber optics is geographically and economically impossible.
And the reason SpaceX can afford to blanket the globe with thousands of heavy satellites comes down to revolutionary economics, right?
Oh, entirely.
Yeah.
Prior to SpaceX dominating the market, sending a payload to low Earth orbit cost the industry roughly $10,000 per kilogram.
Okay.
SpaceX has driven that cost down to under $1,500 per kilogram.
I mean, cutting the price of space travel by almost 90% doesn't just happen because you formulated a slightly better rocket fuel.
No, definitely not.
That requires a fundamental teardown of how aerospace manufacturing actually works.
It does. It relies on three core pillars.
Yeah. I'll walk us through them.
First is booster reusability, which completely eliminates the cost of discarding a multi-million dollar rocket in the ocean after every flight.
Makes sense.
Second is mass production. So building rockets on an assembly line rather than as bespoke artisanal projects.
Right. And the third?
Third, and perhaps most importantly, is intense supply chain verticalization.
Okay. What does that mean in practice?
Well, traditional legacy aerospace companies like Boeing or Lockheed Martin, they act largely as system integrators. They rely on a sprawling network of hundreds of external suppliers for valves, sensors, and alloys.
And I imagine each of those suppliers wants to make a profit.
Exactly. Each supplier takes a profit margin and adds logistical delays. SpaceX, on the other hand, manufactures the vast majority of its components internally. If they need a new valve, they don't wait 3 months for a subcontractor. They just walk across the factory floor and machine it themselves.
They control the entire stack.
Exactly. They own the whole process.
And they need that hyper-efficient, cheap launch capability because their ultimate ambition is a constellation of 42,000 satellites.
That's a massive number.
It is. They have roughly 6,200 active right now.
Yeah.
But they can't afford to slow their launch cadence because the physical space race is escalating rapidly.
Yeah, Amazon is heavily capitalizing Project Kuiper, planning to deploy their first wave of commercial satellites by the end of 2026. And simultaneously, China is aggressively mobilizing a state-backed 13,000-satellite national network called Project GW. So the orbital lanes are getting incredibly crowded.
It is a literal land grab, but executed in low Earth orbit. Global internet connectivity is no longer just a telecommunications issue. It has become a fiercely contested physical domain with massive geopolitical implications.
Absolutely.
So what does this all mean? You listening right now, you are standing at a major inflection point in technological history. Whether you are budgeting to upgrade your Windows machine to avoid a massive ESU penalty, or choosing a new AI coding assistant that runs natively in your Linux terminal, or, you know, just watching the night sky fill with a lattice of internet satellites, you are living through the construction phase of the next era of tech.
It really is a construction phase.
The scaffolding is being built all around you faster than ever before.
But, you know, observing this rapid construction leaves us with a critical question about the permanence of this new scaffolding.
That's a fair point.
We've just discussed AI compute becoming a physical asset class, backed by $500 billion from Wall Street titans who expect guaranteed returns.
Right.
But if we look back at the late 1990s, we saw a massive speculative internet infrastructure boom that led to a spectacular bust. Telecom companies went bankrupt, leaving millions of miles of dark fiber optic cables buried underground, totally unused for years.
I remember that, yeah.
So if the current AI software bubble ever bursts, like if that 67% Gemini retention drops back down, what happens to $500 billion worth of specialized NVIDIA data centers drawing enough power for a small city?
That is a great question.
Do they just become the abandoned shopping malls of the 2030s?
It's a heavy thought, because right now, the foundation feels impenetrable. But we might not know how strong the scaffolding really is until we hear the first crack. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep questioning the systems you rely on, and we will catch you next time.